Please be advised this podcast contains content of a graphic, violent nature. It's not appropriate for children.
Last weekend, a Sydney criminal named Warren Lanfranchi was shot and killed by police. A meeting arranged in a back street in the inner Sydney suburb of Chippendale last Saturday afternoon. Lanfranchi hit by two shots, one in the chest, one in the head, fired by Detective Sergeant Roger Rogerson.
That's the incomparable Ray Martin, of course, introducing one of the biggest scoops of his career. It was the first public acknowledgement of something very rotten going on in the New South Wales Police Force. It was 1981.
Ray even dared to name a high-profile detective, Roger Rogerson, of the Armed Hold-Up Squad, who'd won the highest award in New South Wales policing just months before. But there was no story without the whistleblower, Sally Ann Huckstep, a King's Cross sex worker, heroin addict and girlfriend of Warren Lanfranchi. She was a bona fide member of Sydney's secret nocturnal world of crime and corruption.
But when they killed her boyfriend, she decided to blow it wide open. When Sally Ann approached 60 Minutes with her story, she knew two things. One, she probably wouldn't be believed, and two, she was definitely signing her own death warrant. But she did it anyway. I think it's time to recast Sally Ann Huckstep from heroin-addled prostitute to fearless whistleblower. Later in this episode, we'll hear some of the explosive 60 Minutes interview in which Sally Ann exposed Sydney's most powerful and feared cops for the criminals they really were.
And we'll hear from Sally Ann's sister Deborah about the life and times and the legacy of this latent feminist icon.
How did Sally Ann transition from middle-class Sydney schoolgirl, attending a strict Orthodox Jewish school no less, to become the tragically beautiful face of Australian graft and corruption? And how did the death of a 19-year-old university student, almost 30 years after her own death, finally bring some closure to the Sally Ann Huckstep story?
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb.
Come with us as we discover what makes people killers, what makes people victims, and what happens next. Let's begin at the end of Roger Rogerson's criminal career, which outlasted his police career by some decades. It all came to an end finally in 2014, when Roger and another former New South Wales detective, Glenn McNamara, murdered 20-year-old drug dealer Jamie Gow. Former policeman turned journalist and author Duncan McNabb, who's written two books and countless articles about Roger Rogerson, talks us through the details.
Always fascinates me that Roger's career as a crook ends pretty much because of the involvement of a 20-year-old Southeast Asian university student. I mean, Roger's a notable bigot.
I think it shits him that this is what's got him.
Yeah, he's a 20-year-old kid. He's from an affluent Hong Kong family. He's at university studying business, and here's Roger. And this kid pretty much brings about his downfall. Jamie decided that the straight life, he didn't want to go into business. He didn't want to go into the family business. He didn't really want to finish his university business course either. He thought he was smarter than friends he'd known who'd been locked up for rather large drug deals. He thought, like a lot of these kids, I can do it better. Hey, it's a good life. Chance of being arrested isn't that high. Money is terrific.
It's
in the
a big
lifestyle.
Market, isn't it? Australia's a big market for drugs.
I still think we top the world amphetamine per head usage. So, you know, it's a huge market. He's tapped into sources through his connections in Hong Kong. They can bring the stuff in easy, cheap and fast. He's looking around for distribution networks in Sydney to get his own business going. Quite entrepreneurial, our Jamie. And he said sadly to one of his mates that he always wanted to be a gangster. And a couple of days before he died, he said to them the impending deal with the two old fellas that this would change his life forever. Well, it certainly did. And it's a really sad conversation. He's 20 years old. He knows nothing. Mm. And here he is, these two wizened, old, highly experienced coppers thinking, look at this, a callow youth. And that's, I think, one of the reasons they decided that rather than go into business with him, we'll just kill him and take the drugs.
Really?
Yeah.
That simple? So there was no – I remember there were rumours that Jamie had informed on his gang. Yeah. There was sort of this idea that it was all Asian kind of drama and that Roger and McNamara had just been called in to do the job in the end.
Yeah, there's lovely stories, and I think some of them may have come from Roger's camp at that stage.
Right.
The trial was full of these, the triad, and everyone's whispering, triad. Well, Jamie obviously had triad connections. That's how he got the drugs.
Yeah.
But this drama unfolding in the Sydney streets with triads prowling looking for Jamie Gow, I think that's all nonsense.
Right.
Jamie had the drugs. They'd given it to him on account, by the way, which is not uncommon in the criminal world. All Jamie had to do was take the drugs, pick up the money from the old boys, and off we go. We might have a new distribution network. Roger was extremely well connected with the outlaw biker gangs, particularly the Bandidos and the Rebels. You know, very slick, very efficient distributors of these things.
So we could just get the drugs for free.
Yeah. And Roger just, I reckon Roger just thought, oh, this is too hard. We'll just take the money. And they thought that if they did it properly, no one would know what happened to Jamie Gow. He'd joined the ranks of the missing.
And you're right. They had planned it meticulously, apart from the CCTV camera. So what was the plan?
I think it originally started as a drug deal, and they'd set up a new distribution network using Roger's mates, and Glenn gets Jamie on site to source it. Yeah, great business. At some point, probably around about March or April, I think Roger's just thought, well, I don't want to do this anymore, but you know, well, let's pick up $500,000 or $600,000, which is what it was worth to him.
Wow.
And, you know, if the kid doesn't want to play ball, we'll just get rid of him.
So we lure him to the storage place. We've got the shed all ready to go. We're going to get him in here and shoot him. Then what?
Then we just dispose of the body. They'd already prepared for the disposal of the body. They had the tarp to wrap him in, the surfboard bag. What they hadn't got was they hadn't quite worked out how to get him from the back of the Falcon Ute that they'd bought for this job under a bodgy name.
Yeah.
They hadn't quite worked out the logistics of lifting the body from the ute, from the back of the panel station wagon, I'm sorry, into the boat, because the boat was higher than they anticipated. So they have to whip down to a higher place and get a block and tackle.
God.
And then they wrap poor Jamie up, drop him in the boat. They fail to put sufficient weight on him to make sure he sinks. And I think the most telling moment of that entire afternoon when they're doing this preparation, and it's the moment the jury actually looked and thought, oh, and you could see their faces. When the two old boys hop in the lift, they've got the kid in the boat already. They get a six-pack of beer out, and they're in the lift. And the CCTV camera records them in the lift having a chat, and Glenn's got the six-pack, and they're going upstairs for a beer. And that's the moment the jury turned, I reckon.
Mm.
Just that really simple thing. And the cold-bloodedness. And then the next day they went out, dropped the body off the boat, and, of course, as things happen, if you don't weight them down sufficiently, they come back up again. Two experienced detectives should have known better. I think Roger skimped on the chain because it was expensive.
And then fishermen found something bobbing in a tarp in the water.
Yeah, poor guy's gone out fishing in the morning. He's about 2.5 k's off Cronulla. He sees a white foot in a Reebok. That's what stands out. About 10 years ago when I first wrote about Roger, I'd seen him off into retirement in a tinny with his grandkids, throwing a line over the side, having a cold beer. Boy, did I get that wrong. But here he is in 2014, teamed up with a bloke we all thought was as honest as the day was long. It turns out he wasn't. Roger, infirm, but still sharp. I mean, the mind was like a bloody razor, and I saw him during the court case. No detail missed him.
Yeah.
He was taking notes. He was engaged throughout the entire thing. But here he is. He's got, he can barely hold he's at the pub with his drinking circle. They would have to go and get the round of beers from him because Roger couldn't quite physically deal with carrying the tray of beers out from the bar to the table. But as I also said, Roger could pick up a schooner glass, or I think in Victoria it's a pot glass, and he could still hold it firmly, even though it took him two hands sometimes. Pretty much the same as hanging onto a gun, unfortunately.
I guess, but it's just, you're right. I mean, it's silly. Anyone can murder someone with a gun, but it's so hard to believe these two guys were such a match for this fit 20-year-old. But I guess they just had the experience and the brains. This kid didn't know what he was walking into, did he?
This kid had no clue. He thought he was going into a genuine drug deal. He had the 2.78 or just on 3 kilograms of ice, and he thought the two old blokes were going to bring with them around about the $500,000 to $600,000 in cash.
And he must have felt so safe because they were two old blokes.
Yeah. Two old blokes, and one, his relationship with Roger's co-accused, Glenn McNamara, was very close. They even had pet names for each other. Glenn was referred to by Jamie Gow as son, and he called Jamie Gow mum. So you've got this really bizarre relationship between two people, and then enter Roger. So Jamie was probably feeling reasonably secure when he went into that shed. What he didn't expect was Roger to pull out the pistol, according to Glenn McNamara, and then just shoot him.
Is it true that the shed was already covered in plastic when Jamie walked in so as to help with the cleanup?
It was. They'd prepped it the day before and they'd been there a little bit in the about half an hour before the killing.
Yeah.
So the shed was ready to go. They got a space cleared. They'd actually planned this crime quite well, with one notable exception.
Yes.
They just missed the first CCTV camera.
Right. And it's not the first time that CCTV has done Roger in.
Roger's got a long history. His first brush was back in, gee whiz, the mid-80s, when he was caught in a bank depositing $110,000 into an account not in his name. And he actually turns round and is captured in the bank's CCTV, which for a bloke who worked at the Armed Hold-Up Squad is pretty damn stupid.
Isn't it? And for a smart guy, it's so strange. Because in those days, a lot of our listeners won't even understand how that's possible, but in those days people had multiple accounts in different names.
Yeah, we didn't have the 100 points in those days.
No, we didn't.
Walk in with a slightly dodgy driver's license and sure.
Right.
He got caught again in 1999 when he was being investigated for handing off kickbacks to get contracts for work. And Roger hopped in the witness box, command performance ready to go, tells a whole pack of stuff. The barrister gets him to reassure that, yes, this is 100% accurate. And they just push the play button and they've got hundreds of hours of tapes of Roger. And he was proved to be an absolute liar simply by pushing the play button. And that was his second outing with the electronic surveillance.
Yeah.
He's arrogant.
So when did he become disgraced former detective? Roger Rogerson, which he called himself with some sort of pride for many years.
He's a lovely media performer.
Yes.
The first step towards disgrace was when he shot a guy called Warren Land Franchi, a drug dealer. What he didn't know when he shot Warren Land Franchi was that Warren's girlfriend, Sally Ann Huckstep, who he just dismissed as being, she's a heroin addict and a prostitute. She doesn't rate. Well, she did rate. She was incredibly bright and utterly fearless.
Well, this story is actually incredible, isn't it? Because in the first instance, he murders Land Franchi in the street in Sydney in the middle of the day. He has, was it 16 other police or something involved in this operation backing him up?
Yeah, they're in various perimeters extending through the neighbourhood.
Yeah, and Lanfranchi has ripped off a drug dealer who was associated with Roger. Is that what happened?
Yeah, supposedly Roger and a bloke called Nettie Smith, seriously bad crook, were running a heroin business. Lanfranchi was getting the stuff from them, watering it down again and just pocketing the profit.
Yeah.
The purchasers went back to Roger and Nettie and said, hey, this stuff is crap. So they thought, well, Warren's been playing games. Warren also then took a pot shot at a policeman in the intervening period.
Oh, that's right, a uniform guy. Yeah,
at an armed robbery. Warren was wild and mad. Mm. So Roger made a decision to go and have a chat to Warren Land Franchi, and Warren ended up dead and Roger walked out. He thought he was going to be a hero until Sally Ann popped up.
Sally Ann is incredible. She is the girlfriend of Warren Land Franchi. She is a sex worker and heroin addict. And far from, you know, shrinking into the background terrified, she goes on TV with Ray Martin on 60 Minutes and tells him everything.
I've been paying the police for 10 years.
What, as a prostitute?
As a prostitute. My ex-husband was a criminal. I paid the police many times for him. I would have been quite happy to go on paying the police because it's a way of life and and it's the way you survive. But when the police become judge, jury, and executioner, then somebody has to speak. Somebody has to come forward. Somebody has to start somewhere and stop it. This is real. This is not something that I have made up in revenge or in anger. This is just cold, bare fact.
This is where Warren Land Franchi was shot. There's no question that he was a drug dealer.
But if you listen to his girlfriend, Sally Ann, and her stories about police corruption, she says that some police were also dealing in heroin. She tells one story about how Warren tried to set up what they call in the trade a rip-off, getting heroin without paying for it. But the twist is that even someone as experienced as Lanfranchi didn't always know who owned the heroin and when crooked cops were involved.
It was terrifying and shocked. I mean, it wasn't expected. Heroin rip-offs are a pretty common thing in the heroin business because a heroin dealer can't ring the police up and say, well, look, you know, this guy just ripped me off. Unless, of course, he's working for the police.
Now, Detective Sergeant Rogerson, in his statement, says that he arranged the Saturday rendezvous so that Lanfranchi could give himself up. Sally Ann was with Lanfranchi the couple of hours before that rendezvous. She gives a quite different version of how it came about and the role that was played by the underworld go-betweens.
What did you say to Warren? What were the last moments that you remember?
I asked Warren to bring some flowers home for me. And he turned around and said, well, darling, you never know. You could be sending me flowers. I kissed him at the door and asked him what time he thought he'd be back because I'd be worried. You know, I mean, I didn't want him to go.
You didn't want him to go?
No. And he said he didn't know what time he'd be home, but if he wasn't home by 6 o'clock, then I'd know he'd been killed.
Now, did he say that with a smile? Was he deadly serious?
He was deadly serious.
Sally, there are extraordinary charges. It's the sort of thing that you expect to hear from Hollywood, not in suburban Australia.
I know that, but it is happening here. And I know it sounds unbelievable, but it's real and it's happening.
Do you think the police had no idea that you would take this line? Did they expect you to lie low, to keep quiet?
I think the police thought that I'd shut my mouth, as I've kept quiet all these years. Not only the police, but a lot of criminals are going to be very upset with me. I've upset the balance. A lot of detectives, I suppose, are going to be scared. It's going to be a lot harder for criminals to get away with a lot of things. But it had to be done.
Yep, and she was exactly what Roger had not expected, articulate. She was bright. She made her points clearly and concisely, and she was on the front foot. Roger suddenly found himself in deep strife in the public arena, and Roger always loved the media as well. He's a bit of an old media tart, so finding he was being bested in the public view by Sally Ann Huckstep really hit him hard.
Because he'd done well out of the media too, hadn't he? He'd been championed as a hero.
Yeah, Roger was always. I remember the day after the Lanfranchi shooting, the Daily Telegraph, Sunday Telegraph in Sydney, led with High Noon in Dangar Place, and Roger pitched himself as a Western hero. It was just a remarkable moment.
And Sally Ann, of course, in the sort of least unexpected thing that happened next, is she's found floating in a pond in Centennial Park in Sydney.
Yep, she was in a park in Centennial Park in a pond early one morning. Roger, the night before, was alibied beautifully being on the other side of Sydney with a group of coppers having a drink.
Almost deliberately, some would say.
The three blokes, I'm told, who were responsible for it are still upright and walking around. Yeah, it's one of the intriguing unsolved crimes, and one I really wish they'd sort out.
It's an obvious conclusion in many ways, and yet still sad and still feeling like, God, you can't beat these guys, no matter how brave you are and no matter how publicly you say what's going on, they'll still get you.
Yep, and it took 30 years pretty much after Sally Ann was found dead for Roger to finally end up in the clink for something serious.
Yes, although not for that.
No, absolutely.
So obviously there are probably lots and lots of crimes for which Roger will never see justice, but he is in prison now for the rest of his life, right?
He's in for the rest of his life. He has a genuine life sentence, and given the fact he's now 75, his chance of seeing daylight again without handcuffs is minimal.
How do you reckon he's going in there? Because you wrote that the first time he went to prison, he was actually sort of relieved by how many other former coppers were in there and people he knew.
I think he'll have a, we won't have a great time, but he'll be comfortable. They'll look after him because he's quite aged now. So he's in the aged care facility at Long Bay. He'll be telling stories. He'll be giving advice to other crooks as usual about how they might avoid being in jail, which always strikes me as being a bit bizarre. And he's got arthritis, but he's still a competent pianist. And I understand he's got a piano out there. And someone said he's been giving karaoke, playing for the karaoke teams out there.
I had no idea they had an old age facility at Long Bay Jail.
I didn't either until someone said, that's where Roger is. And I thought, good. I know they've got a prison hospital, but it seems that once they get to a certain age, 70, 75 or infirmity, they're popped into this twilight home for criminals.
God, that sounds pretty reasonable, doesn't it? It's certainly more than he offered his victims.
Yeah, an acquaintance of mine was out there recently and they spotted Roger and he was having a cup of tea, a scotch finger, reading the Daily Telegraph.
It is a bit upsetting, isn't it, to think that he gets to live out his days that way?
He's quite comfortable, yes.
That's Duncan McNabb, author of many fine crime books, including two books on Roger Rogerson. The first one's called The Dodger. That was released in 2006. And in 2016, he updated with Roger Rogerson. Fantastic books. Although, obviously, Emily, he has led us to a very disturbing place, which is the relaxed retirement of Roger Rogerson. It doesn't seem fair, does it?
It's like an aged care home, really, for him, isn't it?
It really is, for all intents and purposes. But I just keep thinking, I've become obsessed with Sally-Anne Huckstep. And I read the book, have you read John Dale's book, Huckstep, A Dangerous Life?
I haven't yet, but it's on my list, my pile.
Oh, God, it's such a good book. And it just talks about this, you know, obviously normal girl, comes from a normal family. Her mum left quite early on, so she and her sister raised by their dad. But Sally-Anne is one of those women we hear about. It reminded me even of the kind of Marilyn Monroe story of these girls who kind of become aware of their power over boys and men quite young and then learn how to weaponise that. That's my sense from the book anyway.
Well, I always remember, you know, vaguely growing up seeing photos of Sally-Anne and she was very striking, very striking, very, I don't know, sassy, sexy, assured of herself. And I guess I like that idea that you're saying we need to reframe her as a real feminist because really she is a very powerful woman and she paid for it with her life.
Oh, the guts it must have taken to sit down with Ray Martin. And even he has to be sort of not disbelieving, but he has to put her through the ringer a bit because the accusations she's making against Rogerson and the other guys who at that time are very highly respected cops, the accusations are very serious. She sits there and holds her ground. And she knew it would be her death knell.
And she was so articulate. And many other people would maybe shrink back and not say anything because, yes, she was a drug addict. Yes, she was a prostitute at times. And, you know, most people would say, well, you know, what is she? Like, she's not credible. But she really is. She's so articulate in that interview.
Yeah.
And just is so assured of what she's saying. It's totally believable when I hear what she's saying.
I'd like to know more about her,
definitely.
More about the person that Sally-Anne was. So I've tracked down her sister, Deborah, who has agreed to have a chat about her memories of Sally-Anne, what sort of woman she was. And, you know, I wonder, did Deborah know how much danger her sister was in? How much did Deborah know about her sister's lifestyle?
And I'd love to know, was Sally-Anne extra conscious about her safety? Did she go about life as normal or was she kind of living a bit of a secluded life after she spoke out?
All right, let's ask her. Here's Deborah Crivishow, the sister of Sally-Anne Huckstep.
Hello.
Hello, Deborah. It's Michelle. How are you?
Very good, thanks.
How does it feel to have someone contact you out of the blue and say they want to talk about your sister?
It feels all right. Yeah, it's fine. I'm quite proud of her, so I'm fine talking about her. Yes, we were very close. Yeah, very, very close. We're only 18 months apart in age, and growing up without a mother in the... you two girls become very close when they're the only females around. Sally-Anne was 20 months old, 18 months older.
I get the impression that Sally-Anne was one of those girls who sort of grew into her sexuality quite young, who realised that it was powerful and sort of revelled in it. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, she was a very, very attractive girl, very attractive. And I think she was mature beyond 2 years. She was powerful within herself anyway. Just, you know how some people, it's funny because she would come across very strong and in her personality and her awareness of herself. But really, she was really quite fragile.
I mean, oftentimes those are the people who feel like they need to appear strongest, aren't they? The ones who are actually trying to prevent other people from realising how fragile they are.
Well, yes, it's bravado, as I would... Oh, that's what I would call it. She had that, like a mask she wore, of strength, and she was very strong, but she still had... She was quite fragile if you really knew her inside.
The sex industry is a scary place. I mean, I worked as a brothel receptionist many years ago, so I'm not going to pretend I can relate to the life that Sally Ann was living in the Cross in the 70s, but it doesn't strike me as a good place for someone who is fragile. What do you think about that?
No, I don't think it's a good place for anybody, fragile or strong. No, I don't think that's a good industry for, especially back in the 70s when drugs were starting to appear, and I don't think anyone had the knowledge of what they could do to you and how long you could be drawn into that lifestyle. So, no, I don't think it's a good industry for anybody, for self-esteem, for anything, whether you're doing it just for drugs or doing it to support children. Or I think, yes, it's definitely not a good industry. And yes, there was a lot of drugs around there in the Cross.
As Sally Ann's younger sister, did she shield you from her lifestyle as it was evolving, or were you aware of it?
No, she didn't shield me. I left home a week after I was 16 anyway. No, we were very aware of what life was about.
You were tough girls, the River Show girls, weren't you?
Well, I think we had to be. You had so many things put on you at first, from being Jewish girls that went to Moriah College that weren't, you know, dark-haired, and that we were very different-looking. Plus, we had no mother. Plus, we were doing things like modelling in our lunch hour or modelling after school. And she had a very... People either really loved her or they didn't understand her.
She must have been intimidating, I suppose, for the other girls. I guess you probably both were.
Well, I think we both had to stand up for ourselves most of our life. There was no one there to stand up for you or to nurture you or to teach you how to do a lot of that stuff. My dad was very involved in his own life and working, and we were left very much on our own from a very young age. So, yeah, and I think when you're out of home, I think she left home around 14. 15 maybe. I know she ran away at 13, 14. Life was like that. You had to defend yourself. You had to look after yourself.
It's just so sad to me that you two beautiful young women felt that way so early in your lives, felt all alone in the world so early in your life.
Well, we did have an auntie, but she was pretty different for the times too. I don't know if, yes, I suppose we were alone as young girls. There was never even Dad's second wife wasn't a nurturing sort of woman towards us at all, especially not towards Sally Ann. So I suppose we were exposed when she left and we were back on our own again most of the time. I suppose we were exposed to more than what most girls at those times. I wouldn't say today. I think today people see a lot more young girls. See a lot more of what's going on in life, whether it's good or bad. But back then, in the early 70s, it was unusual.
Compared to other girls, you girls were pretty world-wise.
Yeah, compared to where we grew up in that sort of... If we'd grown up in a different area, you know, not so middle class, upper middle class, maybe if we'd growing up in places like Redfern and that, where I'm sure a lot of girls struggled there and young boys. But in our circle of people that we knew, yes, we were very different and it was a struggle.
Does it surprise you that the sort of fairly posh Jewish college that you both attended really claims Sally Ann now? I've read a number of articles where they claim her as an old girl and a wonderful whistleblower who's finally getting the respect she deserves?
Yes, it does, because at the beginning I don't think they felt like that at all when it first came about. But it's like, what do they call it? It started off as the tall poppy syndrome, you know, like I don't think people understood what the corruption was like and what she had to face to do what she did until it started opening up more and people, the general public, realised what was going on and how entrenched it was and how dangerous it was back then. I mean, the police and criminals ran their own race and they usually ran it together, playing tag teams.
It's very hard to believe now that people didn't think police were corrupt back then. But back then, when Sally-Ann first made the accusations, they seemed wild to a lot of people.
Yes, I'm sure they did. I think everybody knew that like from Squizzy Taylor days and those, you know, around Taylor Square and all that. But there's police. Look, with power brings corruption. Power and money bring corruption. But I don't think anyone realised how deep it was, unless you were like her or the criminals that were involved around that time realised how big it was and how the distinguishing line between criminal and lawmaker, I don't think there was a line. I'm not saying every police officer or every criminal was involved with each other, but I'd say in Sydney, from what I saw, and Melbourne, they were one of a kind. Yeah. And that's what she didn't like. That's what upset her. She was very staunch in her thoughts. You know, you're either this or you're that. You can't be a lawmaker breaking the law and playing both sides. Do you know what I mean? That's didn't like.
She made that point very clearly to Ray Martin on that famous night, didn't she? She said, you know what, I've been paying the police and I would continue to do it. But famously, she said, when they become judge, jury and executioner, someone has to stand up.
Yes, exactly. And I just think she's incredible for what she did. Yeah. And I don't even think I realised how deep it was at the time. And I'd seen a lot of what was going on, but I didn't realise how corrupt it really was and how dangerous it was. I wasn't involved like my sister was. She was much, much more entrenched than I would have ever been. But the realisation of what it was like, I think it surprised a lot of people. And I think it keeps surprising people that it's still going on. It's just more undercover these days. It's just they just keep it as a better secret.
Where do you think her lack of tolerance for bullshit was born? I mean, that's what it seems like to me. It seems like she's just called out the bullshit.
Definitely, she was that way. This is who I am. This is how I'm having to live my life. And these are my rules and these are how, you know, she knew who she was and she believed in honesty. Yeah, I know that sounds strange because she lived on the other side of what society says is honest, but she was very forthright and very honest about herself.
Where did your mum go?
I think I was about 18 months old and Sally-Ann was 18 months older. Yeah, so she was about 4 and I was nearly 2.
So tiny. Why did that happen? Why did your mum leave?
Oh, I think they were just too young.
Yeah.
She was only 17, I think, when she had Sally-Ann. So she was just too young and I don't think she was a maternal woman at all. I met her again when I was about 50, 52, and I just had no connection with her at all. She just wasn't maternal. She married after my dad and had another 2 children, and I think she basically left them with the father as well.
Wow. Did she ever meet Sally-Ann when Sally-Ann was a grown-up?
They connected when I was about 13 or 14, when I was at boarding school down in Mossvale. She somehow got in contact with Sally-Ann when she was over here, because she lived in the States a lot of the time, when she was over in Sydney. And they ended up getting an apartment together down in Rushcutters Bay. And, of course, she filled up her head with all these, we're going to do this and we're going to do that. And she came home when Sally-Ann came home one day and she was just gone again. Oh. So, yeah, you know.
Her mum left her twice.
Mm.
Yeah.
She never had anybody that really stayed with her. Do you know what I mean? My father never really understood her. He just did what he had to do as a father. You know, he fed us, he clothed us. I think he tried to love us the best he could. But we never had anything maternal in our lives.
Do you think Sally Ann's relationship with Warren Lanfranchi was a special relationship, or was it the sort of circumstances of his death that made it more important to her?
Oh, look, I'm sure she had really strong feelings for him. And when you've grown up like that, I think you're forever searching for love. You know, you're searching for someone to give you purpose and to make it all seem that it's right. And I don't think she ever found that.
So by the time Warren was murdered by the police and a week later Sally Ann appeared on 60 Minutes with Ray Martin to accuse the New South Wales police of very deep-seated corruption, did you know she was going to do that?
No. Mm. No. A couple of days beforehand, but not when she obviously made the decision. She might have told me 2 or 3 days later that this is what she was going to do.
What did you think about that as an idea?
I thought, I just figured if that's what she needed to do that, and that she should do it. She was very strong about it too. She was very... It wasn't right. It didn't sit well with her.
In retrospect, it seems that she was signing her own death warrant when she made that decision. Did it feel like that at the time to you? Did it feel that serious?
Not at the time. We all knew it was serious, but I didn't realise that they would pursue this for so long until they actually got her.
Yeah.
I don't think any of us did. We all thought she was in danger of maybe... you know, getting beaten up or having stuff, you know, false charges against her or something like that. But I never thought it was murder. I never thought it would be murder. I don't think any of us did.
Certainly 5 years later, by that stage, it must have felt as though it was over for all intents and purposes, did it?
No.
No?
No. No, no, she never... I think just before she was murdered, she wrote a letter where she knew she was going to go. They'd been trying to get her for all those 5 years. So she lived in fear all that time, or in uncertainty of what or how or what they were going to do, how it was going to happen.
Now it just seems, she just seems like such an incredibly brave heroine, doesn't she?
I think so. I think people have started to realise what she took on and the depth of it all. And it wasn't just Roger Rogerson and one or two other policemen. There was a lot of them involved in all that. And a lot of them, I mean, I can remember working somewhere in the city in Sydney, and it was a bar that was right near the police centre in I can't remember. And... they used to come in there and I used to get treated so badly that I had to leave. It was all that corrupt, all those corrupt police from in there were just... And that was probably 2 or 3 years after it.
Intimidating.
After Warren.
Sally Ann had a daughter when she died, Sasha, who has gone on to a career. I mean, I've Googled Sasha, not expecting to find anything, but in fact found a pretty high-profile show business career. But I haven't been able to get in touch with her. Did you have much to do with Sasha after her mum died?
Yes, quite a lot. And before her mother died, the three of us were very close. But not in the last probably 10 years, I haven't had much to do with Sasha at all. I think she holds a few... bad feelings because she blames both of us for what happened in her life, which is normal. Mm. I think it's pretty normal to be resentful that she lost out on a lot of her childhood. As much as she loves Cyan and as close as their bond was, I think she still has resentment.
What was your lifestyle like in those last couple of years with Sally Ann? Were you... Oh, I don't... This is very...
Well, no, I was living a different...
Right.
I was living a different lifestyle to Sally Ann.
But I believe Sally Ann was using, and in fact, that was the idea on the night that she died, was that she thought she was going out to score.
Yes. Yeah, she was going out to meet Warren and Warren Richards. Mm. So that was all. Yeah, she was using for sure.
Well,
I mean, that was her. That was her crutch. Yeah, that was her crutch. That was her escape. You know, I'm sure if we all had more information back in the 70s about what drugs were about and what they did to you, we mightn't have stepped up so easily. You know, in the 70s, cocaine and all that was, you know, it was almost fashionable.
Yeah,
it's not like you see with today.
I know this is going to sound crazy all these years later, Deborah, but I'm just so sorry for your loss. I'm so sorry you lost your sister.
Oh, I am too. But, you know, with life comes death. And that's just what life is, you know. And when that happens, you've got to grieve and then you've got to go on, move on and change what you need to change in your life and get to where you want to be in your life. I have photos of my sister all over my room when we were kids and some fabulous photos she had done when she was about 17, 18 and just all through our lives. My dad was a very keen photographer, so I have the most beautiful black and white photos of us. You've got no idea. So, you know, I'm every day I think of my sister at some stage in my life. I've got photos all through my bedroom. So, you know, she'll never be forgotten, but I can't. I grieved when it happened, but I had to go on and then change and get in my life where I needed to be. And that takes a long time sometimes.
Yeah. Are you happy in your life? Are you living a happy life?
I am very happy. Very happy, very healthy, very focused woman. I know who I am at last. I appreciate where I've come from and I appreciate where I've got myself to.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm sure she'd be very proud of you, little sister.
Oh, I'd love to have her here. I'd love to see what she would be like if she could have got to where she needed to be in her life, you know?
Yeah.
And just got clean and felt the joy and the love of what you can do for yourself. Life is so easy if you just play by the rules. And the rules are really simple. What you give out is what you'll get back. What you put into it is what you'll get back from it, you know? And it's just a shame that we both got lost on that drug track back in the 70s and didn't get time to develop and find out who we were. We weren't encouraged as children to where do you want to go? What do you want to be? You know, like we were never asked that question. It was just hurry up and grow up and you know, get on your way. You know, so I think in the 70s when someone offers you, you're lonely and you don't know where you're going and someone says, oh, come here and do this, it's fun. And there's other people doing it and you feel like you belong to someone. It was very easy to fall into that and to feel like you belong somewhere. It wasn't until you'd been involved in it in a while you went, oh, my God, how do I get off this merry-go-round? And it takes a long time sometimes. And then it takes a long time after it to learn who you are and to learn what your personality is and your strengths and your weaknesses and how to work on things. Because you stop growing when you use drugs. Your personality doesn't grow. Your mind doesn't grow. Nothing grows. So, yeah, I'd love to see her now. I quite often think, I wonder what she'd be like and what we'd be doing as sisters and, you know. But I'll never know. I can only appreciate what I had her for and how long I had her for and be proud that that's my sister.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be proud of. Thank you so much, Deborah.
That's my pleasure. Nice to speak with you.
You too. What a lovely
Anytime.
Chat.
Anytime.
That's Deborah Krivoshow speaking about the life, the death and the legacy of her sister, Sally Ann Huckstep. She also spoke at length with author John Dale for his excellent book, Huckstep, which is available now. And if you like reading about true crime, you must read our very own Emily Webb's books, Suburban Nightmare, Murder in Suburbia, and Angels of Death.
You can get your hands on those books by hitting the Shop Now button on our Facebook page.
Thank you for downloading our Australian True Crime podcast. If you have an Australian true crime story of your own you'd like to share with us, let us know on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you.
We'd also love it if you'd give us a nice review and 5 stars on iTunes. Thank you to Sherry Laurie, Michael Davron, Kieran Simpson and Alex Loran for their help in pulling this project together.